last full Thanksgiving break, so I hope you all have a fun Thanksgiving. The story here is I was in Brookhaven Lab, and they have a flock of wild turkeys in the lab. And I sat and watched this guy checking himself out in the reflection of this door for about half an hour. I thought he was pretty funny. So the bad news is we have exam free December 4th. The good news is that is the week after you get back. So I did that deliberately. The bad news with that is that there's a lot of material on it. We didn't have a huge amount of time between the first two exams, so there'll be a good bit on this third exam. And I will try to send out an email today or tomorrow with details of the coverage and the cutoff of that material. Okay? And probably I'll give you, I guess I'll just say it, I'll give you both sides of the 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper this time. So you don't have to mimeograph things quite as small. So any questions on any of that stuff? All right. So we've been talking about fluids, and actually it's a fun topic, probably in lots of ways, but even in how we're going to talk about fluids. I've defined a couple of things, specific gravity. Yes?
It's an exam 8 to 9:15.
I can only do it 8 to 9:15. I don't know why people ask me to do it longer. There's a class that comes in there at 9:30.
It's at 9:40.
I'll look into that. I will use the slot that I can, and I'll usually push it 5 more minutes. So the class starts at 9:40, but I'm supposed to be out of there by 9:20, I think, and I'll let it go to 9:25 or 9:30, something like that. So I'll give you what time I can. I maybe have it. So that class starts at 9:40. At 9:30. Well, I'll try. We'll see. If I didn't, I probably ended the others at what, 9:20? The other time I did it, because I was probably thinking that you had to get out by 9:30. So, okay. Right. So I'll let you go till 9:30. Then. So specific gravity is really a measure of the density of the material relative to something that you can do in the lab in different places, which is water at its densest at 4 degrees centigrade. We will work with pressure usually rather than forces in the fluid business, and we define pressure as force per unit areas. And there are lots of different units that we use for pressure. The atmosphere is a very useful unit if you're in a chem lab, for example. In MKS, you use newtons per meter squared for pascals. The reason an atmosphere is useful in sort of everyday laboratory stuff is because a typical pressure on Earth's surface due to air pressure is about an atmosphere. So there are a couple of principles that we use in fluid statics, and the first is by a guy named Blaise Pascal, French, who lived in the 1600s. And what he found was that if you look at the pressure at some height beneath the surface of a fluid, that the height, the pressure due to that fluid is given by the density of the fluid times g times the height of the fluid, which is not the weight of the fluid. Okay? And another way to say it is the pressure, the absolute pressure down here, is the pressure on top of the fluid, which if it's an open container would be atmospheric pressure, but if it's a closed container, you have to figure out what that pressure is. If you're doing it in detail, it would be the vapor pressure. You know, if you had a vacuum up here, it would be the vapor pressure of this fluid. So in a chem lab, you might have to correct your barometric meter, your barometer readings by that, for example. At any rate, this would be the pressure on top of the fluid, and then this would be the the pressure added on due to the higher fluid that you have. So in English, he said the pressure applied to an enclosed fluid is transmitted undiminished at every point in the fluid and the container walls. And apparently, way back when, he proved this, that it wasn't so much the weight of the fluid that determines the pressure, but the height of the fluid that does, by actually taking a barrel of water and a relatively small pipe that was very hot. Okay? And he knows the density of the water. So he can calculate the weight, the mass of the water that he's basically putting over this barrel. And this is a well-constructed barrel. So he uses a thin pipe here so that the weight of that additional water that he adds as he fills the pipe with water isn't really all that much. But the height is quite big, and he was able to just explode the barrel doing this. So it was a sort of a dramatic demonstration of this principle. And I think this is one of the more common things that people's intuition is just flat out wrong about in physics. So it's the height that's important. The other principle that will really drive what we do in fluid science is from Archimedes, and this is a very old principle. Archimedes lived in Syracuse, Sicily, which was a Greek colony at the time. And he lived in 287 to 212 BC. And what he says is that if you submerge partially or fully an object in a fluid, there will be a buoyant force upward on that object, which is equal to the weight of the displaced fluid. All right, and remember that weight is mg, where g is what we define as the acceleration of gravity on the surface of the Earth. If you took it to the moon, the weight is m with the equivalent of g for the moon, and you have to calculate that. That would be the weight of the substance on the moon, etc. So, okay? Any questions about the basic principles? All right, so Archimedes' principle is also something that's a little bit subtle. So whenever you're facing an Archimedes problem, sort of regardless of what you're given, just say this to yourself and remember that it is the weight of the displaced fluid. And then take that fact and throw it into the problem. Okay, and then hopefully that'll keep your intuition from misleading you, because these problems can be a bit tricky. And so I'm going to do one example where you sort of have to manufacture the answer to the problem by using this, but it really isn't so obvious, I think, when you first start it. So what I'd like to do is to consider, I mean, you've always heard the expression, something is the tip of the iceberg, right? So I think it's probably pretty common knowledge that what you see in an iceberg up above the water is really a relatively small fraction of the iceberg. And the reason for this is that the density of seawater, the specific gravity, is 1.03. And the specific gravity for ice is 0.92, which means ice is almost the same density as the water. Right? And if it were slightly, if the specific gravity here were 1.04, the ice would sink. Okay? So that's not so different. Wood would be a much smaller number, so a much larger fraction of fluid. So at any rate, this question, this problem is, what fraction of the iceberg is submerged? Okay, so that's basically the problem. So to do this problem, what you want to consider is initially think of this iceberg as some sort of mass. So it has the mass of the iceberg times g as a weight, as a weight of the iceberg itself. And then it has a buoyant force. I'm misspelling buoyant. Spell it for me.
B-U-O-Y.
You ever had one of those days where the word just doesn't look right? Alright, I'm going to change this because otherwise I will forget and forever be embarrassed. Whatever. Alright, so we have a buoyant force up, and then we have to consider what these things are. So remember that buoyant force, FB, is equal to the weight of the displaced fluid. So this is all you're given. You aren't even given the free body diagram, but I presume you can write that down. And you know that these two forces have to be equal to each other or it won't flow. But you don't know how much water is displaced. So you sort of have to go to this and just look at the implications of it. You just have to manufacture something out of the fact that you have to go looking for this. That's what that represents. So how do you do it? I don't know the volume of the iceberg, right? So you just have to say, okay, I know the iceberg has a volume. So we're going to let V be defined as the volume of the iceberg. And I'm going to say that of that volume, total volume of the iceberg, a fraction of it, a percentage of it, which I'll call X, is submerged. Okay? So once you begin to define these things, then you can start to actually convert it into some sort of mathematical statement. We know that mg is equal to rho of the iceberg times the volume of the iceberg times g. And here I use the full volume of the iceberg because I want the total mass of the iceberg. So this will be rho seawater times the volume. Okay. Let me back up just a little bit. This will be, that's mg is equal to fb, right? That's the buoyant force up because you're floating. So you're not sinking or flying. Alright, so that's going to be equal to the density of seawater. Right, so because we're looking for the mass of the displaced fluid. So it's going to be the density of the seawater times the volume of the iceberg, which is submerged, which will be X times V. Times G. Okay with this? Any questions on that so far? Alright, so now we're basically there because you say, well, I don't know rho of seawater and I don't know rho of ice, and that's true, but I do give you the specific gravities, so you can just divide both sides by by the rho of H2O at 4 degrees. So when you divide this by rho of H2O at 4 degrees, this becomes the specific gravity of ice which we're given. And when we divide that by 4 degree water, the density of water at 4 degrees, that becomes specific gravity of seawater which we're given. Specific gravities we're given. V we don't have, we just had to pull that up in air, but note that it just cancels because it's needed on both sides. And so now G we know, it cancels as well. So X is just going to be the ratio of the specific gravity of ice to the specific gravity of seawater. And X is exactly what we were asked for, and so this will be 0.92 over 1.03, which, when I calculate it, is equal to 89%. So almost 90% of the ice is actually underwater. Any questions? Alright, so I like this example because it's one where you're actually not given a lot of things. You're not given particular volumes, you're not given densities, and you sort of have to manufacture by thinking your way through what Archimedes' principles really tell you. Okay? There are problems that will be much more straightforward than this, that are much more, you know, they're given the volume, and etc. But this is an example of one that requires you to go back to the principle and think about it. Don't worry about the clickers. We don't have enough of you to do it anymore. Just hands. So, all right. Suppose that we have a pipe that has three different objects connected to it, hollow objects. Oh, thank you. Sorry about that. I can see it just fine. Okay, so let's consider that we have three different shapes. Although I didn't quite draw it that way, suppose that this tube and this piece of this object and this piece of this object have the same width, okay? And that the height of each of the objects is the same. And what I want to do is to have them be connected at their bottoms to a pipe. And how am I going to do this? I'm going to have a pool of water here. No, I'm going to change that. I I will have put water in this pipe and filled it up. Okay, so that the water is coming up to some level in each of these containers. And the bottoms here are at the same height. Okay. And what I would like you to consider is what is the variation in the heights? Okay. Would you expect that A is equal to B is equal to C? Would you expect C to be greater than B, which is greater than A? Would you expect C to be less than B, which is less than A? Well, do less than B, less than A. Or we're going to do C greater than A, greater than B. C greater than B, greater than A. That's just not a good way to do this. Let us just ask, some days I don't think through things because I've done them before and I think I know what I want to do. And another time, and I get up here and I realize, whoa, I really don't know what I want to do here. Let's do this a different way. Okay? What I want to do is say, we have a pipe. And to that pipe, we have either this object, this object, or this object. Consider the pipe to be the same in each case. And now I will fill to a certain height. Assume this height, H, is the same in all cases, even if I didn't draw it that way. But I do want to draw this one better. And now I put a pressure gauge attached to this pipe in all three of them. It's identical. All right. In which case would you expect the pressure to be the greatest at the bottom, according to the pressure gauge? Would you expect it to be A, B, or C? Or would you expect them all to be equal? Okay. Think it's A. You think it's B. You think it's C. You think they're all equal. Alright, so as many of you sort of thought C is thought equal, so let's just do it. What we have this world is a camera hooked to the TV, and we have a pressure gauge, which is clearly not very calibrated, but it doesn't really matter because when I put water in here, at least it will give us a fixed number, so we just have to pay attention to what it measures. Now, what I'm going to do is I have three different shapes which I can substitute in here, and I can provide a level of liquid that should be the same in all three cases. Now, let's just see what it measures. So what I have is a tube with a, this thing is filled with liquid, so if I raise it up, it raises the level of the water. Which is the power of hydraulics. We did that example last time in class. course, we have the same pressure in the tube, and we have small radius here and a big radius here. There's a much larger force if you were trying to have a piston here than there is in the laser. Okay? I believe. You need to see the light. Pascal tells the truth. All right. Now, you want to be... I don't know. If you got a pressure gauge at home, you could probably make some money off your little brother over Thanksgiving doing this in some different glasses. Tell you what. Loads of fun. All right. Now we're going to get wild and crazy and let the fluids flow. Okay? And generally speaking, when things change, we add the word dynamics. So we're going to call this fluid dynamics. Sometimes, because people really consider water for a lot of these things, this is sometimes called hydrodynamics. And in doing this, we're going to make an assumption. And that assumption is, this assumption is that we are dealing with an ideal fluid. So that doesn't mean a premier kind of scotch or something like that. Okay. An ideal fluid is one which has no internal friction as it tries to flow. So if you think about it, if you take a glass full of honey and you turn it over, it doesn't just flow out. There's a lot of internal sticking. Okay, the molecules. So you can think of that as internal friction sort of acting to prevent gravity from accelerating it as fast as it would if it were free of the bottom body, right? If you take water and you do it, it goes out pretty fast. So different fluids have a different degree of this sort of internal friction. And in the fluid world, we call that viscosity. So we're going to assume that an ideal fluid has no viscosity, which you can think of as internal friction. We are also going to have, as part of our definition of an ideal fluid, we're going to say that it's incompressible. So what do I mean if I say it is compressible? If you don't know what I mean when I say compressible or incompressible, then this is just nonsense, okay? So what does it mean? What do you think?
It means it's similar to air.
Air is very compressible.
You can push the same volume into a smaller space.
Okay, so gases are typically compressible, right? You can take them and you can shove them into smaller volumes, and you raise the pressure in doing so. So remember PV equals NRT for even an ideal gas. You can change the pressure by changing the volume and the temperature. So an ideal gas in chemistry is quite compressible, okay? But for us, ideal fluids are not compressible. Water is not so compressible, right? Picture a water balloon that's not super taut, and you can squeeze it here and it comes out there, all right? Now, of course, that happens too if the balloon is filled with air. So it's not so trivial to compress air, but it turns out that water is largely incompressible, so I hope you can believe that. Air, you might think of, is not so compressible, not so incompressible. Incompressible means not compressible. However, there are many circumstances where air is actually, to a large extent, incompressible. So if you are looking at the flow of air past the car, for example, it is largely incompressible under those circumstances, and it flows. It can flow like an almost ideal fluid. Right. Now, these are real assumptions, and one difference between being a physicist and an engineer is a physicist really will use these assumptions to sort of get at the essence of what's going on, and an engineer who wants to really design a plane or a car or something will have to worry about the extent to which these are not quite true. Okay. Or if you want to do an experiment in the lab or something that involves fluid flow, if you want to deal with blood flow or something, how it changes with temperature or whatever. So suppose you become a doctor and you're worrying about surgery and things like this, you may really have to worry about the fact that there are going to be deviations from the ideal fluid aspect of this if you're trying to calculate things that might happen to the blood flow in the body as you change the temperature or something crazy like that, or some sort of blood thinner. The volume changes due to temperature, can't less compression. Probably not. It's probably due to pressure. Yeah, that's a good question. Or good as defined if I don't know right off the top of my head, I suppose. So, okay. Alright, so you'll see sort of where we're using this as we go. So the first thing is, if the fluid is incompressible, then it basically means if I have a pipe and I shove so much fluid in on this end, then so much fluid has to come out on that end. Right? I mean, it's a no-brainer, but we now have to be quantitative about it. And if you think about it, it can become somewhat complex just because pipes do not always have the same radii. So imagine that I have some pipe that grows in radius. And let us suppose that I shove a certain amount of liquid in one end, and we're going to say we have an area 1 over here and an area 2 over here. So area 1 would be the area right there that is perpendicular to the flow of fluid, and area 2 would be the area of this hole. So if I were to take the pipe and turn it toward you, you would see circles, basically, is what I meant to draw. Okay? And let's say that we have some volume of fluid that we're moving into the pipe here with a velocity V1. And the volume of the fluid that you're going to have in this element of fluid that I want to consider is going to be in a time delta t. The volume will be the area times the velocity times delta t. Right? Because this distance is given by the velocity times the time. And if I multiply that by the area, then I'll have a total volume of fluid on that side. Similarly, in the same amount of time, some amount of fluid has to go out the other end of this pipe. And let's say that it moves at V2. So we're going to have a distance here, which is V2 times delta t. If I take that and I multiply that by the area, then I'll have a volume of fluid that moves past that point. Okay? So in physics, we say that we have continuity. That is, however much stuff I shove in here comes out over there. Okay? And tells us that the volume of the fluid on the left-hand side, A1 times V1 delta T, must equal the volume of the fluid flowing out on the right, which will be A2 times V2 times delta T. The delta T's cancel, so we end up with A1 V1 is equal to A2 V2. So the fluid flows fast here and slow here, because the area here is big, the area there is small. But you sort of already know this, right? Would you rather cross a river where it's big and wide, or where it's narrow? The water goes really fast when you get into gorges and you make it sort of narrow. You have a smaller area, but the same volume of water has to squirt through, basically. And when the river has room to spread out, it just is a slow, lazy flow. So that's why if you're into whitewater rafting, you want to go where the gorges are. Because that's where the water's fast. Right? Where the rocks are, so you can die easier. It's great. Alright, so this is a bit of a no-brainer. Are you okay with this? Alright. Now I want to take a step up in complexity, and what I'd like to do is to imagine that we have a pipe here. So it may change in radius a little bit, and it may change in height. And I want to imagine that, because we don't really shove water in one end or anything, we don't have somebody sitting there. Generally what you think of is that water is flowing and there is some pressure at some part of the pipe. So at a given point, the water is flowing through this pipe, and we just say there's a P1 on this end of the pipe and a P2 on that end of the pipe. And let's say that two sections of the pipe that we want to consider, the two ends here, differ in height by some h. And just like we did a little while ago, if over a given amount of time you have some element of fluid flowing in on one end, let us imagine what happens if I take that fluid and follow it as it flows all the way up to that point. Okay? So physics is physics. Doesn't matter whether it's a fluid or a ball or whatever. Energy conservation still holds true. Okay? So I'd like to look at this situation from the point of view of energy conservation. If we imagine, for example, that this is a ball of some sort, then what would be its energy at this point that I should consider? What would be the things you would typically consider as I move it from here up a hill to that point?
A
it would have kinetic and potential energy. So you'd want to know how fast it's moving here and how fast it's moving there. You would consider the change in potential energy, which is due to gravity in this case, the change in potential energy going from here to here. Both of which you'll have. We already saw that depending on the area of the pipe, the velocity can change. So fluids have velocity through a pipe, so they'll have a kinetic energy. This mass, whatever it is, moves up, so there will be a change in potential energy. We have to consider that. In addition, if we are considering a block, for example, that's going up an inclined plane, you also have to consider whether there's some force doing work on the thing, right? Whether there's something shoving it up. So in addition to, if we're going to worry about energy conservation, we have to throw in whatever work is done to go from here to there. So what we're going to say is because of energy conservation, that the work done on this element of the fluid plus its kinetic energy, 1/2 mv squared, where m is, think of as the mass of that element of fluid, whatever it is, plus mgh goes as a constant. Right? It doesn't change. That's what we mean by energy conservation. You okay with that? So maybe for your notes. So let us define V, a big V, as the volume of this fluid element. Okay. Work always goes as force divided into distance. So I'm exerting some force on this element of volume of fluid, okay? And it will go through some distance, so that's the amount of work that is done on it. And I want to divide it by the volume, because I want to sort of say, how much work do I do per unit volume? I have to define that element in some way. So I'm just going to say I have some volume V, and I want to look at work per unit volume. But if I'm going to divide by V, I sort of divide by V everywhere. So this is somehow a measure of the kinetic energy per unit volume plus mgh per unit volume. The volume, V, is equal to the cross-sectional area times the distance that you go, if you're considering moving it through a distance D. The volume that you consider as it moves through that distance D is going to be equal to the area times D. So then if we look at the term on the left, we have F times D over area times D, basically, and the D's cancel. Oh, I don't need to break it up that way. Mass per unit volume here is rho. Force per unit area here is a pressure. MgH over V. Again, this is rho. And this whole thing is equal to a constant because I haven't done anything that would change that. It's sort of been in definitions and dividing through by some amount of volume. So after thinking our way through energy conservation, we get the following important principle, which is that the pressure plus 1/2 rho V squared plus rho GH is equal to a constant. And you say, what is this constant crap? What that means is I can look at the pressure plus rho, 1/2 rho v squared plus rho gh at some point in the fluid flow, and then at some other point in the fluid flow, and they're equal to each other, those quantities. But internally, these things may all vary as I go from one point to another. Okay? So this is really a statement of energy conservation as the fluid flows. And this turns out to be really important, and it is known as Bernoulli's equation. Suppose I move at a distance d. I have fluid in pipe. I move at a distance d. So I will do some work because I'm exerting some force on it through a distance. So that's really all I'm saying. Okay. So I think in this form, it's fair for you to sit there and go, why do I get a crap? Do we have a baseball player in here? Not a single baseball player. You gotta be kidding me. I think that's a first. We've always got one or two. You're always sitting in the back. Are you sure you guys aren't baseball players up there? Yeah, there he is. I knew he was. Okay, let me ask it a different way. Did any of you used to play baseball? Okay. Now we're getting somewhere. Okay. Did any of you used to try to pitch balls at a level, like curveballs and screwballs and stuff? Okay. Did any of you know what a curveball is? Do you know what a screwball is? It is not made with orange juice. Oh, actually. I suppose it could be, but that's not the kind I'm thinking about. Okay. Well, this isn't going to be nearly as much fun then. Holy crap. We need a baseball player in here. Okay. That said, I want to talk about baseball. Right? So I want you to pay attention. And baseball season is still going, right? No, so it just ended. Too bad. All right. Well, you can still probably impress your baseball player friends, you know, if you want, with your knowledge of this, but knowledge is power. Okay, so you might be able to bet them. Okay, what does a baseball look like? Right? It's this white leather, and it also has these little stitches that are in this funky shape around. It's sort of in a symmetrical little pattern. So you get some sort of pattern of red stitching that looks like this, and it goes on the other side. And those stitches are slightly elevated from the surface of the ball, if you've ever handled a real baseball. Okay. And I should have brought one, because it's not obvious to me that everybody in the room here has actually handled a baseball. It's a very American sport. And Japanese. Okay, so if you've ever been to Japan, they're nuts about baseball there. Okay, so in baseball, what you see when you look at a pitcher is that As the baseball flies through the air, it will do different things that they talk a lot about in baseball if you give a crap about it. Me, I fall asleep, but if you pay attention to it, they throw curveballs and screwballs and knuckleballs and fastballs. So these are sort of a generic spread of what these things are. And the reason they're important is because those balls will all do different things in the air. And if the batter, and the ball's coming fast, okay, a decent fastball pitcher is throwing upwards of 100 kilometers per hour or something. I mean, it's coming at you very fast. And it's over a distance of 90 feet. It has to be feet because it's an American game. And I don't have any idea what it is in meters. But, okay. So, they throw it really fast. And so, basically, you don't have a lot of time to process what's going on with this ball before you basically have to swing. So, there's this guessing game between the batter and the pitcher as to what kind of these balls they threw. And the reason that they have to guess is because these balls will all do something different in the air. A fastball basically just goes straight. It does drop due to gravity, okay, because gravity's acting on it, but it's over a very short period of time, so that's not really the dominant thing that happens. And if you bat it a lot, then you sort of mentally correct for that, because that's going to be the same for most of the balls. They can vary the speed, and that can be a big issue. Because if it's coming slow and you think it's fast, it'll swing before the ball ever gets there. So there's a thing called a changeup where they literally try to keep their motion the same, but they throw it a bit slower so that quite literally you swing ahead of time. Then they have balls which they spin in different ways. One is you take the ball with your fingertip and you spin it like that. Okay? So it comes off doing this. Another is where you throw it and you spin it like that, so it's sort of like that, okay? And a knuckleball is one where you literally hold it in such a way that when you throw it, you try very much to put zero spin on it at all, okay? And these balls have different effects at the batter. So let's try to think our way through what's going on. Let's look at this one, which the reason I want a baseball player in here is because I think this is a curveball, but I could be wrong. This is a curve, and that is a screwball, or it's vice versa, and I can't remember which is which. But let me suppose we'll call this one a curveball for now. All right. So there's the ball. I'm the pitcher, right? I throw it, and I spin it like that as it leaves my hand. So, from our point of view, it might be at a slight angle, but why don't we assume that it's just basically straight up and down. So, what I want to do is to consider the motion of this ball as it's flying through the air. Here it is, and it's going to be spinning like this as it moves through the air. This means that the threads on the surface of this ball are spinning around very fast because it's a real whip action when you throw it. The air is passing over the ball like this. As the ball flies through the air, okay? You can consider the change in height for the ball to be negligible, right? It's a fairly small ball. The air flow across the ball is going to basically be the same as the ball moves through it, because the top and the bottom are moving at the same speed. But there's a catch. You've got the threads on the ball that are spinning, okay? So what that means is that threads are moving this way over the top of the ball, and they're going to slow this air flow right across the top of the ball a little bit. At the bottom of the ball, the threads are moving in such a way that they'll speed the air flow up a tiny bit at the surface of the ball. So that means that we have some velocity of the air up here, which I'll call V top, and some velocity of the air at the bottom, which I'll call VB. Okay? And let's look at Bernoulli's equation, which is right up above us, as we think our way through this. What it says that if I consider this fluid in these two cases, it's not a fluid that's flowing through a pipe, really. You sort of think of this ball flowing through the air as creating similar situations on the top and the bottom. And we can use Bernoulli's equation to sort of compare what the situations are. So what it says is that the pressure plus 1/2 rho v squared plus rho gh at the top should be equal to the pressure plus 1/2 rho v squared plus rho gh at the bottom. The air pressure, the external air pressure, is effectively the same. No, let me rephrase that. Let's say that the height difference is negligible between these two things. So we're going to just sort of say that these two cancel out. Okay? And now that leaves us with a situation where we have the pressure at the top of the ball plus 1/2 rho velocity of the air at the top of the ball squared is equal to the pressure at the bottom of the ball plus 1/2 rho v bottom squared. By the argument that we made with the threads at the ball, the air here at the top, Vt, is moving slower than the air at the bottom, Vb. So that means Vt is smaller than Vb. And that tells you that's true. If this is smaller than that, then this has got to be smaller than that. And if I have this object and I have a pressure here which is greater than here, which is what I've got, okay, then there's going to be a force on it. In addition to gravity, it's going to literally make it move down. Okay? So what that says is that if I throw this curveball, then as that ball goes, it's going to do this, going toward the back. Okay? If I throw it like that, same argument, it's going to do this. Okay? If I throw it with a knuckleball, that is, it's not spinning at all. If it's a perfect knuckleball, it's just flying through the air. Basically, you're going to get random orientations of the threads going up against the air. So you'll have slightly different amounts of friction depending on the orientation of the ball. And it can even change as it's in flight a little bit. And the ball is going to dance a little bit in sort of unpredictable ways. Okay? So you can control what's happening with the ball if you're a good pitcher by how you spin it. Knuckleball pitchers are typically really hard to hit because they don't even know where the ball's going to go, right, once they throw it. But they're really hard for the catchers to catch the ball because they don't know where the ball's going to go, and the hitters have a heck of a time. They're also very hard to control. So do we have tennis players? Okay, so we've got some tennis players. So suppose you want to hit a really, 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 really hard serve. How do you do it? If you're a tennis player, if you look at them, when your game develops to a point where you start doing more than this, okay? The whole idea is to hit the ball as hard as you can into this little box on the other side. And it has to hit somewhere in that box for it to be good, okay? The problem is that box is pretty small once you're starting to hit hard. So if you hit the ball flat, you're going to miss that box. And it's really hard. It's really hard if you're really tall, you have some angle to hit down a flat serve straight into the box. But if you're relatively short, you don't have much of an angle here. So you can do One thing is to hit it fairly soft so it just sort of falls in. But the other thing you can do is when you serve, you take the racket and you whip it up over the edge of the ball. Okay? And when you do that, you impart a lot of top spin on the ball. And when you have top spin on the ball, tennis balls are fuzzy, so you have sort of the same effect happening here. You get this kind of effect. So you'll have a bigger pressure on the top and the bottom. And what happens when you get a top spin serve is the ball's coming in, it just sort of, it forces it down. And then it has the additional effect because they have to hit it after it bounces. And so because it's not spinning so fast this way, it has a big jump like that. So if you watch in tennis, at a high level of the game, spin is really important because if you watch them too, when you first take your tennis lessons, you know, you learn, okay, so you're supposed to pivot as the ball's coming in, you bring the racket back, you step forward, you hit the ball right here, you go straight through the ball and you do this. Okay, that's basically tennis. So, and you do it with the backhand like that. Look at the great tennis players. They don't do that shit. What do they do? They're like, bam, like that, right? That's what they do. They look like there's some ping pong player on steroids or something. Just, bam, bam. And the reason that they do this weird motion, okay, is because they're trying to rake that racket across the ball so they can hit it as hard as possible and put so much topspin on it that it drops into the court and then bounces really hard. Right? So that's what they do. And you'll see very different styles. So the women's game has evolved through the years. Now the really powerful players play the same way. But sometimes you'll see women, relatively few men, but in old days, there was one particular player, if you ever see historical tapes of Chris Everett is her name, she's still alive. But she was a phenomenal player, but she didn't play that way, okay? She hit straight balls, pretty much, but she just never missed. But she, you know, it's a very different sort of game. So the whole game has its different styles. But if you look at spin is everything, drop shots, what they'll do is they'll cut underneath the ball, and what happens there is exactly sort of the opposite. You're increasing the pressure on the bottom of the ball. You also usually take some power off, okay? And if you hit it really hard, it just will fly over the fence. But if you hit it relatively easy, what will happen is it's coming in, and literally the spin sort of elevates the ball as it slows down, and then it just drops, right? So it's a way of just, instead of doing this over the net and bouncing really hard, now it just sort of drops, and now because it's spinning backwards, instead of taking off like that, it sort of stops and dies. And so it's really hard to get. And that's the shot you pull out when somebody's, you know, way in the back. Okay. So you'll see, excuse me, players using spin and basketball up against the basketball board, but there, I think it's not the air pressure that they're using. Okay, there it's the spinning against the board as it hits. It's more the factor. But anyway, that's why you should give it practice. It's cool. Spin's very important in ping pong. There, you don't have friction on the ball so much, but you do. You still have the spin. It's just you don't have threads on it. But you can totally change the game if you put a little bit of stuff on there. Golf balls have all these silly little dimples, and that turns out to be getting into the region where I think we are not really dealing with ideal fluids. It turns out if you put all those dimples, you reduce the amount of friction as the air passes over, and they can go much, much farther than they can if they were dead surfaces like ping pong balls. Yeah. This applies to airplane wings, which is the next topic. So if you look at airplane wings, if you were to take a saw and just cut them and look at the cross-section, after you get out of jail, you might be able to analyze it. But if you look at the shape of a basic airplane wing, It looks something like this. And the shape is something which we call an airfoil. And let's say the plane is moving this way through the air. So that means that the air is moving like so. As it goes around the wing. If we argue that the air is incompressible, which is, there are aerodynamic engineers, which you do want to have done homework before you get on the plane to design, because there are approximations that we make. But one of them is if to a decent approximation, consider the air incompressible. If it were really compressible, then basically you would build up a bunch of air here and sort of have a vacuum here. But that doesn't happen. The air flows pretty smoothly. So that means that it takes an element of air here, a certain amount of time to go across the wing, and an element of air here, about the same amount of time to go across the wing. You don't have big pressure differences, okay? So if that's true, then the air here must move a little faster across the surface of this wing because it's designed such that this is a longer distance than here at the bottom. So if the air is moving a little faster through over the top of the wing than it is across the bottom of the wing, then as we just learned, that means the pressure here, if V is bigger, P is smaller. P is bigger on the bottom, but V is smaller on the bottom. So you'll have a pressure difference. Wings are big. If you have a pressure difference, and slightly more pressure on the bottom than you have on the top, over a large area, that's a big force. Okay? And so that is the force that, one of the forces that keeps an airplane in the air. Okay, the shape of the wing is very important. As you go faster, you have this velocity flow increase, but there's another effect, which is as you start moving fast, if you take the wings and you do this just a little bit, the air coming in literally bounces off a little bit like that and can also give you this force up, right? So the problem is if you're going fairly slow, that's a lot harder to do because the air, not so much air is bouncing off the surface even if you put the wing like this, okay? So if you've ever noticed when you're on a plane, when they're getting ready to land, they make all sorts of weird noises. So the first time you're on the plane, you swear to God you're going to go down, right? Because like, that's just the thing opening to let the wheels out, and then the wheels now have a lot of air friction, it's like, and and if you look in the wings, they have these big flaps that are starting to extend out. And so, right? And then even as they're getting really close to landing, they'll take these flaps and they'll do this. You'll have to turn them down. So you've got this whole wing here, and then you've got this whole extension out that does this kind of crap. Okay? So it may feel like they're not really doing that just to scare the bejesus out of you. Okay? What they're doing is they are increasing the lift because they're also slowing down. They're slowing down a lot. I had a friend talking to a friend who's playing one of the engines blew, and the plane basically then had to make an emergency landing. And in the process, they lost their hydraulics. And I mean, I have two different stories with this, but my friend who was on the plane happened to be sitting beside a pilot for the airline who happened to be just flying from one point to another, who I don't know what possessed them to do this, but they come on and they say, you know, we're having a little problem, we're going to have to land, and we're going to need to give you emergency procedures because we don't have hydraulics, so we have to land going fast. And the pilot beside my friend looks over and goes, holy shit, we're in deep trouble. You're not supposed to be saying stuff like that. So at this point, my friend gets a little upset. But, you know, they said it got very quiet and that they gave all the instructions of how to, you know, tuck your head down and all the stuff that they do. So why was this a big deal? It takes, you're moving these massive plates down and there's a whole lot of force on them, so they're held really tightly. And often, at least some element of this is done through hydraulics, okay? And we learned about hydraulics already, which means you can get a tremendous force over here for a small force over here if you just do it through sort of the size of the piping. So this is done to control all sorts of mechanical things. So in this case, you use your hydraulics in planes to control the flaps. That's what moves this stuff out. That's what. So if something happens and you lose pressure in that fluid, if the fluid starts leaking out, you are unable to control those flaps. So in this particular case, it means they have to land without using the flaps. It's a big deal. If you have the flaps down, okay, then you have an extreme airfoil, which gives you a lot of lift for relatively short, relatively small velocities of the air across it. And as you slow down, that's what you want. So that's why they have to extend the flaps, so that they can actually be relatively slow when they touch down the ground. In this case, my friend said, I hadn't really thought about this, but because they don't have hydraulics, they can't put the flaps out. Because they can't put the flaps out, they have to come in really cooking, right? They're really moving fast. And it has to be really scary. So they landed, and everybody's really relieved because they just landed. And when they landed, they saw all these ambulances and fire trucks and everything just racing along. And the brakes are, they slammed on the brakes and everything, so they just stopped this 747 or right before the end of the runway. And the pilot comes on and says, you're going to see a whole lot of fire trucks around. We're okay. Nothing happened. But basically, all of our brakes and tires are on fire right now. Because they had to slam on the brakes, and there was so much friction going on that they just... So basically, they have to come in and put the fires out before they can let people off the plane. So it's... Oh, I'm out of time. I'm sorry.